I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. There will be no Straight Talk Express in New Hampshire today, or this weekend for that matter. Republican presidential candidate John McCain, once considered to be the GOP frontrunner, doesn't even have the money to keep his bus on the road. That bus, the Straight Talk Express, was central to his maverick image during his bid for the White House in 2000. But now the entire campaign is running out of gas. McCain's White House bid is broke. His chief strategist and campaign manager have resigned, and nearly half of his campaign staff is gone. Joining us on his cell phone from the campaign trail in New Hampshire is Mike Allen, longtime political reporter, now writing for Politico.com. And Mike, welcome.
Howdy, Anthony.
Good to have you on the show. Mike, what a difference a few weeks can make. What explains this implosion of the McCain campaign?
Well, money affects buzz, affects endorsements, affects staff morale. All those things have come together to make this a really hard time. You can survive without money, but you can't survive forever with the perception that you're in an insurmountable hole. Anthony, people want to be with a winner.
Right.
And the problem now for Senator McCain is to get people to come on, whether it's an activist or whether it's a staff member or whether it's a big endorsement. That's going to be a real act of love and faith, and he already has those people. So where to grow is very difficult from here.
He had $24 million. Now he doesn't have anything. What happened? Was this just a case of building a campaign staff that was too big and too fat and spending too much?
Right. It was built on a financial plan that called for them to raise much more money. Now, this would not be an outrageous amount to spend if you had it, but they had way more consultants than they needed, and they were basically geared up to run a general election campaign rather than a sort of lean, mean, insurgent primary campaign. So now they're stripped down to, they say they're focusing on three states, that's at the very most, and they say that they have the money to do it, but everything's being done very economically. Senator McCain flew in here last night on a coach seat on U.S. Air, and they plan to, he's staying at a courtyard by Marriott.
I see. Political observers are saying he may end up driving the Straight Talk Express himself. Do you think he can turn this around? I mean, his campaign manager, Terry Nelson, has resigned, along with McCain's longtime strategist, Jim Weaver. Now Rick Davis, another longtime McCain guy, is running the stripped-down operation. Can he do it? Can he turn it around and resurrect this campaign?
Right. For the reasons you're pointing out, Anthony, the heart and brains of the McCain operation have left. John Weaver, who was the chief strategist, as you know, has been John McCain's Karl Rove forever. Not only was the mastermind behind the very successful 2000 campaign, but he's basically been devoting his life to this campaign ever since. I can think years ago, Weaver talking about having conference calls with activists in South Carolina and New Hampshire. This has been his life. So, McCain's campaign was almost unimaginable without him. So now he's trying to go on with a very, very, very small staff and recognizing that the only hope for him is if, A, he catches on with the town meetings that he's doing, and he is very good in that format, and, B, that the opposition really stumbles. Both of those things would have to happen for Senator McCain to last.
Isn't one of the big problems, though, again, comparing it to his very successful run in 2000, where we should remind listeners he won New Hampshire by 18 points. But, I mean, one of the big differences this year is he is running a campaign where he's pro-war, where he's supporting a war that's extremely unpopular. That's a big difference than 2000, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that the campaign hoped that people would appreciate the fact that McCain, who's known for his straight talk, would be telling people something they didn't want to hear, but that he clearly deeply believes. Also traveling with him this weekend is his 19-year-old son, Jimmy McCain, who's a Marine, is planning to deploy eventually. So there's a very powerful message from John McCain on that, but the country is just in such a different place. And somebody pointed out to me that there was basically a mathematical problem. If you lose moderates, independents, on the war and you lose conservatives on immigration, that doesn't leave many people.
That's a big problem. Let me ask you finally, Mike, just about sort of a mood question, because I remember covering the Straight Talk Express back in 2000. The mood on it, especially in New Hampshire, was positively giddy, happy, almost silly at times. I gather much different the last few weeks.
Right, Anthony, I think giddy is a good word for it. I think that that was the case. Senator McCain, as you know, uses the expression from the Navy, steady strain. That's what he's trying to keep going here. But this can't be fun. So they say that we are going to see sort of John McCain shooting from the hip more, just being himself. But with so much uncertainty, very hard for this campaign to be the exciting place that it once was. It's going to be tough to recapture that.
All right, Mike Allen. Well, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Anthony, have a great weekend.
Yeah, you too. That's Mike Allen. He's chief political reporter for thepolitico.com, talking to us about the struggles of the John McCain campaign from New Hampshire. It's 24/7. Do you know what your children are doing online? Text messaging, instant messaging, posting on MySpace, downloading music and movies. Teenagers are online virtually all the time. In fact, this hyper-connectedness is one of the characteristics of teens and of tweens at the start of the 21st century. As kids navigate this brave new world, the once solitary act of writing in one's diary or passing a note to a schoolmate can now reach millions of people. Anastasia Goodstein is author of Totally Wired, What Teens and Tweens Are Doing Online, and she joins us now. Anastasia, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in. Give us a sense of what you mean by totally wired. How totally connected are teens and tweens today?
Well, I definitely think that teens and tweens have always sort of gone through this developmental phase where they're individuating from their parents, they're spending more time with their peers and their friends, and there's just this desire to stay connected to them. I mean, we stayed connected to them on the phone after school. We'd be talking to the same best friend that we sat with at lunch, and then we'd talk for another hour about pretty much nothing. I mean, I'd sit there with the phone in my ear, and I think that that instinct, that desire is still there. There's just now a whole arsenal of digital tools for teens and tweens to stay connected with. So they can instant message, they can leave comments on each other's blogs or MySpace, they can text each other. They can do all of this literally 24/7.
And what is this doing to them? Does it mean teenagers and tweens are changing?
I don't think that they're changing per se, but they're definitely learning sort of a new set of ways to communicate with each other, right? So technology, for example, puts distance between people. So you can say things you might not say to somebody in person. In that way, you can sort of be meaner, and that happens a lot with cyberbullying, but you can also flirt, you know, you can be more honest, you can be closer in a way to a friend because you can say something over IM that you might not be able to say to them in person. So I think it's added sort of a whole new dimension to teens' friendships.
Now, you're 35 years old, you're not a parent yet, and as you mentioned, you sort of came of age as a teenager in a very different world. Why did you write this book? What were you after here?
You know, I was definitely a rebellious teen myself, and I think that my struggles in my teen years sort of led me to the work that I do, which is chronicling youth culture day in and day out on my blog. And I think you can't do that now without, you know, talking about teens and technology. And I think when MySpace really hit a tipping point and there were millions of teens on the site and I started to see the coverage around what they were doing on MySpace, and it felt maybe a little bit hysterical, a little bit of a moral panic starting to happen, which tends to happen whenever there's a new technology that's popular with youth. And I wanted to kind of write a book that would be a voice of reason and, you know, help parents to navigate this new territory, but not scare them.
This idea of moral panic and it occurring in the past. When did it occur in the past?
Well, it's funny. It actually occurred around reading way back when, in the 18th century, when young women who were working in the factories began to read novels, and that created a panic. And then, of course, you know, it spread to the movie houses when those became popular with young people, and we had Elvis and his swiveling hips and comic books. And, you know, it's sort of like with any new form of entertainment that became popular with young people, parents were terrified of what that would mean.
I'm curious about this idea of the effect of all this on free time. That seems to me that that's changed radically, especially with this idea of kids capable of multitasking, being online, sending instant messages, watching TV, listening to the iPod, doing it all at the same time. What does that do to a kid's awareness of the world around them?
This generation doesn't have as much free time as my generation did. I mean, they are considered the most scheduled generation. You know, after school, they have sports practice or SAT prep or, you know, any number of activities. And we do live in a world now where there is more fear and parents are less willing to let their kids go hang out somewhere. So I do think, you know, what free time they do have, they are spending in these virtual spaces. It's kind of like the new mall, right? I mean, malls across the country have begun cracking down on teens and actually launching curfews and having parents accompany them to the mall. So all those physical spaces that we used to hang out in, they're just not hanging out there anymore. They're hanging out online. So teens are definitely multitasking. I think that the myth is out there that they are these amazing multitaskers and can do it better than everyone else. And I think most of the research on what happens to your brain when you're doing too many things at once says that's not true. So I actually encourage parents, especially when teens are doing their homework, they need to be logged out of IM. They need to minimize all the windows. They need to have their phone turned off, because the reality is when you're doing too many things at once, it's easier to make mistakes. You're not going to retain as much.
Teenagers need to be aware of the consequences of, for example, posting on MySpace. This can be seen by everybody. It can be seen by colleges that they might be applying to. It might be seen by potential employers. In other words, do they have to be more conscious of the way they're sort of expressing themselves in these very public forums?
I do think this is very much a generational difference. I think that, you know, this generation is more comfortable living their lives online. And yes, I think that there have definitely been jobs lost and consequences experienced for posting, you know, inappropriate content on these sites. But if an employer is actually looking at a candidate's personal Facebook profile and sees some photographs of this young person at a party, maybe with a cup in their hand, is that a reason not to hire that person? I mean, I think these are live issues right now and something that, you know, the professional world is grappling with. Some companies say, we're not going to look because we know that those are very social spaces. We get it. Other companies look for red flags. So I do think we're in the middle of it right now, and I do think that, you know, teens are suffering the consequences, but these same teens are also going to be the recruiters in the future, and it'll be interesting to see if it changes. You know, I think this is a big generational gap and difference in how adults and young people view privacy.
And we'll talk more about kids online. Stay with us here and now. I'm Anthony Brooks. It's Here and Now. We're talking with Anastasia Goodstein, who keeps track of teens and technology on her blog, and her new book, Totally Wired, What Teens and Tweens Are Doing Online. For a parent's perspective, we're joined as well by Catherine Platt, a professor of anthropology at Babson College in Massachusetts and the mother of two teenagers. Welcome, Catherine.
Thank you very much.
Tell me how your kids use the internet and what you're observing.
Well, both of my girls used MySpace and instant messaging and Facebook, probably other things that maybe I don't know about. They definitely use it with their friends, not just to connect to them when they're absent, but I actually feel a little bit more anxious sometimes about what they do together.
What are you anxious about?
if my kids go to somebody else's house and there's a rec room and there's a computer down in the rec room and the parents are upstairs, I just think that that's sort of the peer situation where kids will dare each other forward.
Anastasia, what's your advice to Catherine and to parents in general who have some of these concerns about what are the kids doing down there in the rec room while the adults are upstairs?
Well, the first thing I would say would be hang in there. We all survived those years ourselves. And I think, you know, in some ways, there's more of an opportunity in these virtual spaces for parents to be involved. Hopefully, they will put their cocktails down and go downstairs and sort of really engage with them. And part of it is just growing up, too, and kids are going to have that time away from parents.
But there are potential problems out there that weren't there before. I mean, the problem of online predators, more pornography, which we referred to, stranger danger. How big is this risk without sort of pumping up this moral panic? How aware should we be about that?
Well, I mean, I definitely think it's important to be aware there are predators offline as well. I mean, the good news is that I think most teenagers, when an adult contacts them online, because they really are there to socialize with their friends, most of whom they know offline, they're not really talking to strangers. And when a creepy adult contacts a teen, I mean, most of them just delete, block, you know, unfriend, encourage them to talk to you about it if it makes them uncomfortable. But most teens won't respond. It's actually the teens who are responding that I'm really concerned about, because I think that those are teens that are actually probably having some issues at home. Maybe mom and dad aren't getting along. Maybe they've been victimized in the past and there's some reason that they are connecting to these predators who, you know, are pretty upfront about who they are and what they want.
Catherine Platt, how do you monitor some of this stuff and where do you draw the line with your teenage kids?
Most of their computer activity they do on a laptop that's usually in a room where I can walk in and out. And sometimes I see the screen changing. So, you know, they definitely want their privacy. But I, you know, consider it an open door kind of a situation so that they know that I know what they're doing. I check the history. And if I see that there's something wiggy on the history, I'll talk to them about it. I'll say, this is really creepy. And I don't think I'm going to be able to patrol and police, and nor do I want to. But what I try to talk to them about is the choices they make. And I say that has an impact on you and how you think about, you know, the human body, or your visual sexuality is really influenced by that stuff. That's not good. I just try to be very upfront about what I see as the risks and the dangers, and also just walk through scenarios about being sensible.
Catherine, so, do you feel like you can keep up with your kids with the technology? But I mean,
no,
I get the sense that some of these kids...
Not.
No, okay.
I'm sure I'm not up to date. But, you know, I do talk to their older cousins who are young adults and who are very computer savvy, who are willing to talk to me about it. You know, I do tell my kids, don't post anything on the internet that you wouldn't want grandma to read, because she will read it, and she can. So
Does that sound like good advice, Anastasia?
That sounds like great advice. Yeah. Teens are slowly starting to realize, some of them the hard way, that what they post on a lot of these sites is public unless they make it private. I think what we're seeing now is actually a lot of teenagers using privacy settings where they weren't before, because they really did think that their MySpace profile was just for their handful of friends, and they didn't realize that grandma or the cops or teachers or even a recruiter for college or your summer employer could see those profiles. So I think that message is starting to sink in.
Well, I wouldn't really even rely on privacy settings. I think it's just so important for them to realize that the privacy or anonymity that they think they have is a complete, you know, illusion.
Well, Catherine, thanks for joining us. I really
sure.
appreciate it.
Thanks for chatting with me.
That's Catherine Platt. She's a professor of anthropology at Babson College in Massachusetts, and she is the mother of two teenagers. Thanks again, Catherine. Well, a brave new world indeed. But it's a challenge for parents, isn't it? I mean, as we just heard from Catherine Platt, parents in many cases just aren't technologically as evolved as their kids. I mean, so how can they monitor this? You know, how do they really know what's going on?
Actually, you don't have to be so tech savvy to be engaged. I mean, you don't have to understand HTML or how all this software works to set limits and tell your child, okay, it's time to go to bed. Turn the cell phone off and leave it in the kitchen so you won't be text messaging at 3 a.m. You don't have to understand technology to do what parents do best.
But is there a broader concern here about how this is affecting teen-parent communication?
I think if anything, it's really an opportunity for parents to be closer to their teens. It is something that teens have grown up with and are more comfortable with. So it's a great opportunity to let them show you, you know, how it works, to have them show you MySpace or show you Facebook, you know, because teens are putting so much of their lives online. They are creating these digital trails. I mean, all the stuff that used to happen in the shadows, you know, the sort of teen life that you just, you know, took a deep breath and hoped that when you weren't there that everything would come out okay, you can see that now. You can find it online. And that might be very disturbing for some parents, but I actually think it's an opportunity to find a red flag and actually do something about it.
Anastasia, you've given us a lot to think about. Thanks for coming in today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Anastasia Goodstein is author of Totally Wired, What Teens and Tweens Are Doing Online. Just ahead, Japan's new earthquake warning system. You're listening to Here and Now. I'm Anthony Brooks. It's Here and Now. Here's a brief update on an effort to make low-cost laptop computers available to children in developing nations. The nonprofit group called One Laptop Per Child has been trying to line up governments in several countries to buy their affordable wind-up computers known as $100 laptops. Well, it appears the project has moved a step closer to reality. According to the Associated Press, the nonprofit has made peace with Intel Corporation, the project's biggest and most powerful rival. Intel produces its own low-cost computers. But under the deal, Intel will join the board and work with the project. The project to seed the third world with cheap laptops is being pushed by Nicholas Negroponte, co-founder of MIT's Media Lab, who calls his One Laptop Per Child project the most important thing he's ever done. Now, moving to another story about new technology. Here's a sound residents of Tokyo and other Japanese cities hope they never hear. But chances are they probably will. It's an automated computer-generated warning counting down the seconds until an earthquake will hit. And scientists say given the nation's geology, the probability that a major earthquake will strike Tokyo at some point in the near future is almost certain. Joining us now is Jean Kumagai. She's a reporter for IEEE Spectrum magazine, and she traveled to Tokyo to find out how Japan is preparing for the next seismic disaster. Jean, welcome.
Hi there.
Jean, before we talk about what the Japanese are doing to prepare for these earthquakes, I want to talk a little bit about sort of Japan's history with earthquakes. They've had five major quakes in the last three centuries. The great Kanto earthquake of 1923 killed more than 140,000 people, leveling cities like Tokyo and Yokohama. Just 12 years ago, an earthquake flattened Kobe and left 6,400 people dead. So if a major earthquake were to hit Tokyo today, what would be the consequences?
The consequences would be really dire, not just for Tokyo, but really for the world. According to a Japanese government study, if a magnitude 7.3 quake hit downtown Tokyo during an evening rush hour, it would result in 11,000 deaths, 210,000 injuries, and it would destroy something like 840,000 buildings, mostly from fire. The total cost would come to something like $1 trillion, which is quite a bit more than Japan's entire annual budget. So now that Tokyo is, you know, a major center of commerce and industry and culture, the impact on the global economy would be devastating.
Yeah, I was going to say, this sounds like a disaster that would go well beyond the confines of Japan. It would really be felt around the world.
That's absolutely true.
Okay, so the 1995 Kobe earthquake, in your article, you sort of described that as a wake-up call. So the Japanese government is trying to create a nationwide system that could detect the first rumblings of an earthquake and send out an instantaneous warning. How would this work?
Well, earthquakes have this peculiar property. They send out different types of energy waves. There's primary waves and secondary waves. And so the primary waves travel quite a bit faster than the secondary waves. So if they can detect the earliest primary wave, they can send out an alert before the secondary wave hits. And the secondary wave is really the one that does all of the damage in an earthquake.
So what's the lag between the primary wave and the secondary wave? That is the lag between the warning that they could send out and when the earthquake would actually hit.
It depends on how far you are from the earthquake center, the epicenter. If you are right at the epicenter, there is no difference. The primary and secondary waves hit almost simultaneously. But if you are some distance away, and the further you are from the epicenter, the greater the difference in when the waves arrive. So you have some amount of time to react.
Hmm. But we're just talking a question of tens of seconds, maybe.
It's not hours or right. days.
So what does that buy a potential earthquake victim or a city? Getting a warning that basically there's going to be an earthquake and it may be major and it's coming in 18 seconds. Why is that any good?
Well, for anything controlled by a computer, which these days is just about everything, it's actually quite a bit of time to react. The microprocessors inside computers, you know, they deal in millionths of a second. So it would give them enough time to, say, shut down a power or a chemical plant if it were doing something particularly dangerous. It would give trains and subways a chance to slow down and or even stop. In people's houses, it could automatically shut off gas valves, unlock doors, and trigger the alarms.
What about the concern about false alarms? You write that in Tokyo there are tremors just about every other week on average. So if these tremors are triggering these alarms so often, it seems like there'd be a risk of the public growing kind of jaded, or, you know, not to mention the potential for economic disruption.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And the Japanese government is very concerned about people just going nuts. They actually delayed the rollout of the alert system in order to give the public more time to become educated. There have been all kinds of media campaigns and educational campaigns in schools to tell people what they should do should they hear these alerts.
So the goal is to set up a system that would cover the entire nation. The infrastructure is now in place. What still needs to be done?
They have all of the seismic stations. They have the high-speed communications links. They have the software to run these things. But they still need to develop the applications for the alert information. And the government has, I think, wisely chosen to leave that to the private sector. So you actually have a lot of entrepreneurial activity in Japan trying to develop little devices that can handle the alerts and develop information systems that people can buy as part of their, say, their internet service. And so that will take some time for people to, I guess, realize how they can make money from it and for, you know, consumers to figure out what they want to want to buy.
Now, to what extent are other parts of the world that are prone to earthquakes watching what is going on in Japan? I'm thinking of places like Mexico City, Turkey, Tehran, of course, California. I mean, are they watching with interest what's going on in Japan?
I think earthquake experts are extremely interested in what's going on there. I don't know how much governments and the general public is really aware. It is extremely expensive to put such a system in place. I mean, the Japanese government spent millions of dollars over a number of years, and that may not be possible for poorer countries.
Right. Well, it's an interesting story, and it appears in the magazine IEEE Spectrum magazine. And Gene, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks so much, Anthony.
Appreciate it. Gene Kumagai is a reporter with IEEE Spectrum magazine. For more on how cities can prepare for earthquakes, go to our website, here-now.org. Now, a brief note about next week on Here and Now. We're going to consider to what extent 21st century America resembles the Roman Empire. We'll speak to Cullen Murphy, author of Are We Rome? Also, poverty is a campaign issue. John Edwards retraces Robert Kennedy's 1968 journey to Appalachia. What's changed in the 40 years since his trip? Still to come, the music of British R&B singer James Hunter. You're listening to Here and Now. So, you think your job stinks. Well, rest assured, there are jobs that stink a lot more. Consider, for example, the work of a whale feces researcher. According to Popular Science magazine, that occupation, whale feces researcher, comes in 10th on the list of the worst jobs in science for 2007. And it turns out there's one right here in downtown Boston. And joining us now is Rosalind Rolland, a senior researcher at the New England Aquarium in Boston. You're a whale feces researcher, and I sort of have trouble saying that with a straight face. I know it's a serious job, but please tell us what your job entails, so to speak.
Well, I do collect whale feces, and the reason that I do that is to study reproduction and health in the North Atlantic right whale, which is a very highly endangered whale. There are only about 400 surviving now. And in the 1990s, the reproduction in this population really declined, and in the year 2000, there was only one calf born. So my job was to figure out what was going on with right whales, and I'm a veterinarian by training, and I learned pretty quickly that I can't get the usual blood samples and do an exam on a 50-ton whale that's swimming around out in the ocean. But I came up with the idea, based on studies that have been done in other species, that you can measure hormones in fecal samples and find out if animals are pregnant, if they're lactating, learn about reproduction that way. So
fascinating. Now, I have to ask, how do you go about obtaining these samples?
One might wonder. Well, the first year, I went up to the Bay of Fundy, where right whales are in the summer months, and the aquarium has a field station there, and we photograph right whales and do population surveys. So I went up there armed with a net, basically a fine mesh fishing net, to see if I could collect whale feces. So basically, when we would either see a whale poop or we would smell a whale defecation, which has a very unique odor, I would go over and scoop it up, and I found out pretty quickly that I could collect whale poop, and things have progressed since then, and I now use specially trained dogs, detection dogs.
No kidding, dogs. So whale poop, one can only imagine that these must be large samples?
that's
how
large?
Everybody, how big?
Everybody wants to know what it looks like and how much there is. Well, I don't mean to disappoint you, but sometimes when the whale isn't present, we just find very small floating chunks. However, other times when the whale has just left the scene, we have been in the midst of a field probably 20 feet in diameter of floating chunks of whale feces.
Goodness.
It's quite amazing.
That's Rosalind Rolland, senior researcher at the New England Aquarium. She's also co-editor of the book The Urban Whale, North Atlantic Right Whales at the Crossroads. So what could be worse than studying whale droppings? Well, according to Popular Science, the worst science job is hazmat diving. To find out what that is, we're joined by Stephen Barsky. He's author of Diving in High-Risk Environments. Stephen, welcome.
Nice to be here.
Will you tell us what hazmat diving is?
Sure. There are many people who have to dive in environments where we know that the water is polluted. And it may be polluted due to chemicals. It may be polluted to primarily biologicals, probably the most common hazard that people encounter.
And what kind of risks are associated with this kind of diving?
The risks primarily today involve not only the diving itself and the hazards of the environment, but also the equipment. The equipment is heavy, it's hot. Think of a person responding to a hazmat situation topside and the type of suits they have to wear and that sort of thing. It's similar types of things for diving, and you're usually wearing a diving helmet.
And can you give me an example of the worst kind of dive you've heard of? I mean,
well, probably the very worst one I've heard was the guys who had to dive in a hog waste lagoon to recover a body out of that lagoon. A truck driver accidentally backed his truck into the water and drowned. and they knew he was there, and they went in to find him. The liquid and solid matters are extremely viscous, so you're not really going to swim. You know, you're going to crawl, basically what you're going to do.
And I imagine visibility is next to nothing.
It is nothing.
It is nothing. Well, Steve, thanks very much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
No problem.
That's Stephen Barsky. He's a former commercial diver and author of Diving in High-Risk Environments. He's an expert on hazmat diving, which currently holds Popular Science magazine's vaunted title of the worst job in science. It's Here and Now. I'm Anthony Brooks. It's Here and Now. James Hunter comes to the stage as a soulful R&B singer with a heavy-duty endorsement from none other than Van Morrison, who says that James has one of the best voices in British R&B and soul. He's already been compared to Van Morrison, to Sam Cooke, Ray Charles, and Bobby Blue Bland. He says he makes music you can groove to. And here's a little of that groove, the title track from his latest CD, People Gonna Talk.
I know people gonna talk the way they do sometimes.
James Hunter is touring the United States, Great Britain, and Canada this summer. Robin Young spoke to him when People Gonna Talk was first released.
The rumor is that Van Morrison got the tip-off about you from one of your fans at a newsstand.
That's right. Well, he was a plant. He's a mate of mine, so I put him up to it.
But what, I mean, really, did you hear about this afterwards? What did he say to Van Morrison?
Well, he just made dire threats, you know, if he didn't come and see us at some gig or other, and Morrison must have taken it seriously because he turned up to a few gigs we were doing in Wales.
And what does that mean to you, to have Van Morrison show up?
Doesn't hurt, does it?
No, it does not. Well, you know, I mentioned all the voices you've been compared to, including Van Morrison. I was listening with a friend, and he said, "Is that Sam Cooke?" So, do you hear that a lot?
It's hugely flattering. I mean, it is deliberate. I mean, I've been trying to cultivate that kind of voice ever since I heard people like Jackie Wilson and Sam Cooke, Ray Charles. I started off copying everyone I could think of, and hopefully started coming out with my own thing a little bit.
Well, tell us a little bit about that, because we understood that you're one of those English boys who fell in love with classic American R&B. When? How?
I think it started with one record. It was Reap Petite with Jackie Wilson. We had a copy of that in a... I lived in a caravan with my family, and we were a bit starved for entertainment.
Is this a caravan? It's like we call it a trailer or an RV in this country?
Exactly, yes.
Yeah, and this is in Colchester, England?
Yes, it's in Thorington Cross, just outside Colchester, and the bit that the Romans didn't invade, because there was nothing there but a crossroads. Yeah, we just had this Dansette record player and a bunch of 78s that our grandmother had given us.
Uh-huh. Well, it's so funny, talking to you now, James Hunter, and having listened to a lot of your music, I'm struck by the difference. And let's listen a little more to some of your CD. Let's listen.
Sure.
That wonderful richness and world weariness and bluesiness to your singing, and you are the most chipper person I've ever met. is there a difference between the person that sings and the person that sits and...
No, because really, by its nature, R&B is pretty chirpy anyway, no? Muddy Waters can get down with the rest of them, but a lot of it's quite lively, you know?
Well, I want to talk a little bit about the sound that you were able to capture on the CD, because it's so warm. It sounds like it was recorded in 1962, and that you recorded it trying to get that sound. How?
We did it at a particular studio called Toe Rag. And this fellow specializes in not messing records up. You know, he uses analog equipment, and there's certain processes that people started doing in the 80s that this bloke bypasses, you know.
Right. We understand it's antique, practically vintage analog equipment. No yeah. headphones. The musicians aren't separated in glass booths.
That's it. We're all stuck together in the same room. Very little separation. But the better you feel it when you're feeling off each other, the less you need separation.
Right.
You know, you're more likely to get it right.
No digital enhancement?
I don't think so, no. Not that he told us about.
Well, and that's the sound we're about to hear. Terrific sound. I'm wondering, do you have the experience that a lot of white Anglo R&B singers have, that when people meet you, they say, I thought you were black?
Yes, they do.
Yeah.
Yes. Sometimes they say, until you started singing, I thought you were black.
and again, you, as you said, you grew up in this poxy little caravan.
Poxy, yes.
What does that mean?
Poxy is just a general term of disparagement. You know,
it's sort
of like not terribly good. Yes.
Mom and dad in the living room, and
that's right.
Is there something about having had that beginning and growing up listening to the old records that, you know, you have to work to hold on to in the music?
Actually, I mean, you never lose sight of the love of it, really, if you had it in the first place. So, I mean, it's just obstinate single-mindedness has kept me on, and the desire to avoid having gainful employment.
I want to get back to that comment, though, because you said that sometimes they thought you were black until you started singing.
Mm.
are any of those people who've said that to you black artists?
You know, black civilians, but not black artists as such, no. I've been, funny enough, I mean, a couple of people have sort of warned me that there are a lot of African-American people might take exception to sort of white bloke, approximating their sort of style, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And
has that happened?
No, not yet. You know, I haven't had... I'm prepared that if anyone wants to sort of accuse me of cultural plagiarism, I'm just going to put my hand up and admit to it, you know.
Because you love it.
Yeah. It's, I'm doing it for the right reason, you know. If I've got a mission, it's basically to shove America's nose into its own dustbin and tell it, look, this is what you've discarded.
This is the music you threw away, as, and you've remarked on this, as another group once said.
Yeah, which pretty much was what the Beatles were doing, you know.
Because people criticized them as well for singing, you know, the blues and African-American songs, and they said the same thing.
People say the same thing of Elvis.
And so you come to this country thinking, geez, why aren't you guys singing more of this kind of stuff?
Yeah. I say, if you don't want it, I'll have it.
That's R&B singer James Hunter speaking with Robin Young. James is touring the country this summer. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. And while you're there, download a podcast and take us with you wherever you go. We leave you with a little more from James Hunter's CD, People Gonna Talk. This is Watch and Change.
But I won't be led around by the watch and chain. So come on, come on, come on, come on, baby. My love the strongest in the land. I don't want to hear no maybe. You got my future in your hand.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Have a great weekend and join us again here and now.
But darling, I could only climb so high on no pride at all. So I can keep my pride if it's all the same. And I won't be led around by the watch and chain. So come on, come on, come on, come on, baby. My love the strongest in the land.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.